It didn't take long for Danvers to understand Molina's problem. Before the main courses were served, he realized that Molina was in love with her. But she loved Bracknell, the eternal triangle, Danvers thought. It has caused the ruin of many a dream. For himself, Danvers treasured Molina's company. Despite his atheistic barbs, Molina was the only close friend Danvers had made in this city of godless technicians and dark-skinned mestizos who worshipped their old blood-soaked gods in secret. Yet the question nagged at him. Why is Molina here? What can a biologist do for this mammoth project? After many weeks of asking everyone he knew, even men and women he had barely been introduced to, the path to understanding suddenly came to him like a revelation from on high. The woman, Lara Tierney, she is the key to Molina's presence here. To get him to tell the truth, Danvers realized to open up his inner secrets, I must use his love for this woman. That's his vulnerable spot. Still, he wavered, reluctant to cause the pain that he knew Molina would feel. Danvers prayed long hours kneeling by his bedside, seeking guidance. Do I have the right to do this? He asked. The only answer he received was a memory of his mentor's words. Remember that you are doing God's work. And then the revelation came to him. The way to promotion, the path to advancement within the new morality, was by stopping this godless project. That's why they sent me here, he realized, to see if I can prevent these secularists from succeeding in their blasphemous project. That's how they're testing me. Danvers rose from his knees, his heart filled with determination. The hour was late, but he told the phone to call Molina. He got the man's answering machine, of course, but made a date with him for dinner the following night, not lunch. What he had to do would take more time than a lunch break. Better to do it after the working day is finished in the dark of night. Be hard, he advised himself. Show no mercy. Drive out all doubts, all qualms. Be a man of steel. Dinner wasn't much. And afterward, Danvers and Molina walked slowly up the gently rising street toward the building where they both were quartered. The sky tower was outlined by safety lights, flashing on and off like fireflies, trailing upward until they disappeared into the starry sky. A sliver of a moon was riding over the mountains to the east. The sky was clear, hardly a cloud in sight, the night air crisp and chill. All through dinner, Danvers had avoided starting this probe into his friend's heart. But as they approached their building, he realized he could delay no longer. Victor, he began softly, you and Bracknell and Miss Tierney seem to be old friends. We all went to university together, Molina replied evenly. The lamps along the street were spaced fairly widely, far apart enough for the two men to stroll through pools of shadow as they walked along. Danvers saw that Molina kept his eyes down, watching where he was stepping, rather than gazing up at the sky tower looming above them. You studied biology there? Yes, said Molina. Mance bounced around from one department to another in the School of Engineering. And Miss Tierney? Through the shadows, he could hear Molina's sudden intake of breath. Lara? She started out in sociology, I think, but then she switched to engineering, aerospace engineering. Can you believe it? Now, that was after she met Bracknell. Yeah, right. After she met Mance. She went so goofy over him that she switched her major just to be closer to him. You were attracted to her yourself, weren't you? Fucking lot of good it did me once she met Mance. Danvers walked down for a few steps in silence. He heard the bitterness in Molina's voice, and now that he had touched on the sore spot, he had to open up the wound again. Did you love her then? He asked. Molina didn't answer. You still love her, don't you? That's none of your damn business, Elliot. Well, I think it is, Victor. You're my friend. I want to help you. How the hell can you help me? You want to pray for a miracle, maybe? Prayer has its powers. Bullshit! Danvers nodded in the darkness. Victor's in pain, no doubt of it. My task is to use his pain, channel it into a productive course. Why did you come here, then? If you knew that Bracknell was heading this project, didn't you expect her to show up sooner or later? I suppose I did, subconsciously. Maybe I thought she wouldn't. That they were finished, I don't know. But you came here to this project. Did you volunteer, or did Bracknell ask you to come? Mance called me when he got the go-ahead for the project, all excited, said he needed me to make it work. He needed you? Like an idiot, I agreed to take a look at his plans. Next thing I knew, I was on a plane to Quito. Why did he need you? I didn't think Lara would come down here, Molina went on, ignoring the question. I figured Mance would be so fucking busy with this crazy scheme of his that he wouldn't have time for her. Maybe he'd even forgotten her. Damn fool me. But, why did he need you? Danvers insisted. To make the buckyball fibers, Molina snapped. What the fuck do you think? Ignoring Molina's deliberate crudities, Danvers pressed. A biologist to build the fibers? A biologist, yeah. Somebody who can engineer viruses to assemble buckyballs for you. You need a damn smart biologist to work down at the nanometer scale. Danvers sucked in his breath. Nanomachines? They were under a street lamp now, and Danvers could see the pain and anguish in Molina's face. For several long moments, the biologist struggled for self-control. At last he said calmly, coldly, "Not nanomachines, Elliot. Viruses. Living creatures. Is this what you're after? Trying to find out if we're using nanotech so you can turn us into the authorities?" "No, Victor, not at all," Danvers half-lied. "I'm trying to find out what's troubling you. I want to help you. I truly do." "Great. You want to help me? Find some way to get Mance out of the picture. Get him away from Lara. That's the kind of help I need." Atlanta. The headquarters building of the New Morality was not as large as the capital of a secular government, nor as ornate as a cathedral. But it was, in fact, the seat of a power that stretched across all of the North American continent north of the Rio Grande and extended its influence into Mexico and Central America. In the days before the greenhouse floods, the New Morality was little more than a fundamentalist Christian sect, sterner than most others, that concentrated its work in the rundown cores of cities such as Atlanta, Philadelphia, Detroit, and other urban blights. It did good works, rescuing lost souls, driving drug dealers out of slum neighborhoods, rebuilding decaying houses, making certain that children learned to read and write in the schools it had installed in abandoned storefronts. In return for these good works, the New Morality insisted on iron discipline and obedience. Above all, obedience. Then the Earth's climate tumbled over the greenhouse cliff. After half a century of warnings from climatologists that were ignored by temporizing politicians and ridiculed by disbelieving pundits, the global climate abruptly switched from post-glacial to the kind of semi-tropical environment that had ruled the Earth in earlier eons. Ice caps melted. Sea levels rose by 20 meters over a few years. Coastal cities everywhere were flooded. The electrical power grid that sustained modern civilization collapsed. Killer storms raged while farmlands eroded into dust. Hundreds of millions of men, women, and children were driven from their homes, their jobs, their lives, all of them hungry, frightened, desperate. The New Morality rejoiced. "This is the wrath of God that has been called down upon us," thundered the Reverend Harold Carnaby. "This is our just punishment for generations of sinful licentiousness." Governments across the world turned authoritarian, backed by fundamentalist organizations such as the Holy Disciples in Europe and the Flower Dragon in the Far East. Even the fractious Muslims came together under the banner of the Sword of Islam once Israel was obliterated. After decades of authoritarian rule, however, people all across the Earth were growing restive. The climate had stabilized, although once again scientists were issuing dire warnings, this time of a coming ice age. They were ignored once again as the average family moved toward economic well-being and a better life. Prosperity was creeping across the world once more. Church attendance was slipping. Carnaby, now a self-appointed archbishop, mulled these factors in his mind as he sat in his powered wheelchair and gazed out across the skyline of Atlanta's high-rise towers. "We saved this city," he grumbled. "Yes, sir," said one of the aides standing behind him respectfully. "We surely did. We saved the nation when it was sinking into crime and depravity," Carnaby added. "Now that the people are growing richer, they're turning away from God. They're more interested in buying the latest virtual reality games than in saving their souls." "Too true," said the second aide. Carnaby pivoted his wheelchair to face them.